Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Kevin, and this is another moment in time. I've got my guest,
Lynn Bukowski.
Beautiful. And for those of you who are joining for the first time or longtime listeners, as you know, Moment in Time is set up to showcase people and share their journey or a little piece of it in hopes that it inspires others. So sit back. Lynn, what are we talking about tonight?
I think I'm going to just talk about my life and marriage to Steve Bukowski and how that turned into a place called LZ Grace Warrior Retreat.
Beautiful. So I think you framed it perfectly, Lynn. Why don't we start with kind of the before, the love story, and then we'll get to how it turned into what I'm going to call your life mission right now.
All right. Well, I met Steve back in 1978. I was singing in a band and going to college at the time. And we were doing a private, what we call a private gig, in Coronado, California. And Steve and some of his friends that he was with crashed the party. And he walked up to me while I was in the middle of a song. The song is Moon Dance by Van Morrison. And I was right in the middle of it, and he asked me to dance. And I thought, well, he was a really, really good-looking man. So I had to, you know, pause in the middle of my song. But I thought, oh, what the heck. And So I did. I danced with him while I sang the rest of the song. And so that began quite a love story. And from there, we dated for probably 10 months or so. And then he asked me to marry him. And then he deployed to the Philippines. And I followed him, actually, with a girlfriend. We were just going to go visit for a couple of weeks. But at that time in 1978, it was martial law and in the Philippines. And that meant that I, as an American citizen, couldn't be on the streets of Longapo or anywhere in the Philippines without an escort, or as I could be a military dependent, or I had to be a student. And I was neither. I was just a tourist. And so Steve was called to leave for a mission, and we had about 10 hours, and we ended up rushing through and getting married in the Philippines so that I could be a military dependent.
That's
and
awesome.
He could leave on his mission. It was in the middle, 10 o'clock at night, in the middle of a typhoon, and in what's called the Christian Servicemen Center, and there was no electricity. So it was quite a, that wedding day was quite an adventure.
So after you all got married, how long did you stay in Singapore? Or the Philippines, I mean.
After we got married, I was in the Philippines for about 8 more weeks, and then I flew home, and he stayed out the rest of his deployment. So I didn't see him then for about 6 months after that. And then he came home to Coronado.
And then kind of walk me through what was life in this kind of, I'm going to call it a whirlwind marriage. What was life like after Steve got back from deployment?
That first deployment, things were okay, but very quiet. And the thing about deployments and returning home is I didn't know. I was very, very young. I didn't know that he needed some time to unwind. We call it decompression now. I didn't know that then. So I took it personally and thought he just didn't like me anymore. I was a brand new bride. And what I came to find out years later, actually, it was probably about 5 years into our marriage before he finally took the time to tell me that when he left on a deployment or a mission, because sometimes it wasn't a full deployment, and came home, he needed some time and space and compared it. He made the analogy, it's like doing laundry. He needed to wash his thoughts and what he'd just been through, like laundry, clean it really good, fold it, put it away in a box, lock it down, and then he could rejoin life. And I thought that was a really wonderful analogy because it let me understand 100% what he was doing. Not ignoring me, he was just train to be back home.
That's really, really cool. And as somebody who works with a lot of trauma people, I often get to, you know, work with the families who are not quite understanding what somebody who goes through trauma or a deployment in this standpoint, what life is, you know, after, because it, every time they experience something like that, or they get re-victimized or deal with new trauma, like mm-hmm. a version of them freezes. So it sounds like he had to take that time to kind of get back to his old self, the version you knew, and leave whatever negative stuff he had behind him.
That's exactly right. And I like that you use the word freezes, because I think they do have to defrost a bit. I think that's a really good word to use. And come back. And I think that over the years, and I was married to Steve for 31 years before he died, over the years, I realized that he changed just a little bit about who he was each and every time he came home. And that stayed, but it was more for Steve, and I think he was one of the fortunate ones. He really could separate. He really could designate that, you know, these thoughts don't belong in this world, so I'm putting it away for right now. I'm locking it down. And it did not fracture him the way it does some people these days. He was just able to do that. But he did change just incrementally. And he would, if I can say so, because, you know, everything now seems a lot more romantic and wonderful, but it was really hard. It was really hard work to stay in a marriage where sometimes you knew him and sometimes you didn't. So, but it was like kind of being married to a new person all the time. Yeah. We kept it exciting.
I was going to say, that is kind of some exciting, because I know a lot of people that I get a chance to work with, you know, the version that comes back after the trauma and, you know, they're recollecting the pieces, it's almost like a recovered file. Like whatever happened in between just has to go away and there's new recovered file. It's sometimes the person comes back completely different. Like they no longer are in love or they're no longer have the similar interests. So it's really cool that you got a chance to be his dance partner as he went through that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the more that I work with people now who are going through, mostly I work with men who come here to the retreat, because for right now that's the only people involved in special operations combat. But the marriages, the way things are breaking apart has an awful lot to do with that. They come back and they feel that they're changed people and they can't re-enter for whatever reason. They cannot step back into who they were before they left. We just give them some time to rest and maybe come to terms with it's okay to be a little bit different and learn from it and turn it to a positive, which is not always easy, and go forward, because we all reinvent ourselves all the time. I mean, those of us who have not been in combat do, right?
No, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, of course. Like, I actually share with most of my clients my philosophy of suicide, and mm-hmm. it gets this negative, you know, idea that it's end of life. But I tell them all the time, there's certain versions of Kevin, like the one that came from Ohio, that version of me I'll never be again, because I have, you know, 4 years now of experience living in California. So if I ever were to move back, it's a brand new version of myself. Or like when the Japanese, you know, there's in their culture, if something breaks, instead of discarding it, they take it and have it mended in gold and it becomes this whole new piece. It's almost more mm-hmm. beautiful this time.
That becomes a precious part of yeah. what that piece was. Yeah. I like that.
Mm-hmm. And that's why when you were kind of describing, you know, the guys you work with, they come back and they're trying to get back to themselves. It's almost like you're helping kind of mend them in gold to be the newest, best version that they can be.
Oh, well, that's humbling. I hope that that's the case. And I do believe that, to be true, because gosh, that just humbles me. I don't think it's me. I think it's through me, not of me. Mm. And, what I have found here, and I know I'm kind of skipping around, but what I have found with the men who come here is that they, after they leave as a guest at the retreat, they actually return to drop in after they get back from their next deployment, or to ask if we need anything done, or to serve as mentors for the new people that are here. And that to me is the biggest testimony that it really is true that if you have a safe place to come home to, and you don't have to be anybody, you can just be who you are, or figure that out with no pressure, that it's healing. It's healing in a way that you can rejoin society and people and want to stay a part of that.
Yeah, I think it is that level of just that gift of acceptance where they can just be who they are with no judgments, just take the time, you know, and it sounds like you sit with them in their darkness, like, you know, we as therapists sit in people's darkness.
Yes.
And I think this...
And I'm not a therapist. I'm trained in crisis intervention and management, but I'm not a therapist. So that almost relieves them of that...
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It relieves them of the obligation of they have to talk about themselves. They don't really.
Yeah. Because sometimes
I have to say.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because sometimes I have to tell my clients, like, my counseling hat's not on. Let's just have a conversation.
And isn't that funny? It's really interesting that people do that. But I like to say that this is a safe place to break. And then I make it so. It's a safe place. We all have to break, and it's really uncomfortable to break where we're not safe.
And I think this is a perfect time to kind of introduce Elsie Grace to the people, so as we're kind of talking about it, they understand kind of what you're referencing.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I did kind of jump the gun there. Well, Elsie Grace is a warrior retreat for special operations forces coming home from combat. Specifically designed to be confidential and secure. And I work with a very small group of donors. I'm hoping to enlarge that, but the main point is that we are a 501c3, but I don't function as other nonprofits because I can't go out and fundraise and be public about it. I promise every single one of these guys and couples and families who come here that they, their name and when they're here will never be exposed, so that they have the opportunity to come someplace where it doesn't risk their career. Most of them are active duty, or risk their security clearance in case they want to transition out into a different kind of job. That said, I have in the last year opened it up to also what I like to call my three-letter agency family. I didn't realize so many folks forward deployed. I didn't know that until just this last year. So they come down from Washington, D.C. a lot. And I have also opened it up to firefighters and local police officers because they sometimes experience trauma on a daily basis. With no real place to go to kind of shove that off of them.
No, that's really awesome because, like, most of my clients are trauma clients. So just the idea of having somewhere for that, especially for, you know, your population, is definitely a saving grace, because a lot of times you look at the people and only an hour a week is not enough to really help them process what they're living in 24/7.
No, but I can see that it can give them the tools to do with what they can for the week and come back and see you again. This is more of a place where I have two rules at the retreat. They can come in, by the way, and stay for a long weekend, Friday to Saturday or Sunday, or they can stay a week. I have one person here who will be here probably long-term, a couple of months. And I have two rules, and that's that they eat dinner with us at the table every evening, and that they meet at the fire pit when I light it up. And during the day, they can. I have a meditation garden, and I'll bring yoga instructors in as needed for that, or they can just do it on their own. I have a climbing wall, kayaking, a gym to work out in, a library, and we have 36 horses on the property, three dogs now. We had four a couple of weeks ago, but three dogs now that are companion dogs, and several guinea hens. And a couple mules and donkeys. So they can choose to sit in a chair and read a book or just fish on the dock and just do their own thing. They're not pressured to do any. There's no schedule is what I'm trying to say.
No, that's really cool.
And I think that they live their life by a schedule. So they need to be someplace where they don't have to worry on that.
Mm-hmm. And nature is always a great place to kind of recharge too.
It is. And this is 38 acres. We like to call it 38 dark. because it really just feels as though we're not that far from the city, but it does feel once you drive up the driveway. The driveway is a quarter mile long. So once you drive up the driveway, you do feel as though you're separated from the outside world, and which is a nice, safe feeling, kind of a deep breath,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
So tying this back to kind of your love story, you know, we talked about the past when you first got married, and now, you know, Elsie Grace is your present. Help us kind of tie the lines or fill in the blanks for us.
Well, Steve was throughout our marriage, and this probably began about the second year of our marriage. We lived all over the world, and what he would do in his different platoons and squadrons is kind of take the younger guys under his wing, some of the older guys too, and bring them home and surprise me and walk through the door with 10 people and say, you know, what's for dinner? And, you know, during that time in our lives, we had not a lot of money. So it really did turn into kind of a fun, I don't know, let's just see what we have. And that continued. So he'd bring the guys home and they'd sit around and eat and talk. And I called it BS sessions for the most part. But it really helped to straighten out any issues, to talk about what they'd just been through. And he did this continuously wherever we lived. And what happened with that, and, you know, there were years in there also going forward that we became foster parents for special needs infants. And so he'd bring the guys home, and there'd be these big, huge men walking through the door, all muscles. They, you know, they didn't know what to do with the baby, but I would hand them an infant anyway, because if I was going to cook, they were going to help hold. And it just kind of became a big revolving family, if you will, because every couple of years it was different people. Or a different country or state. Our kids, Stephen and Sherry and Aaron, who we adopted 26 years ago, they just grew up with this. They thought this was normal life, that this constant revolving door of men coming through. And a really wonderful thing happened, and it really helped Steve and I clarify our marriage. The younger guys would then start to bring girlfriends over for my approval. It wasn't stated like that. It wasn't like, can I have your approval? But that's what it ended up being. And so I've really, really been fortunate, and I'm very grateful that I got to meet a lot of girlfriends before they were wives. I got to meet, and then once they were married, I got to you know, meet the babies. And some of these people were older than I was, but I became the den mom of a whole lot of tough guys, or who thought they were tough.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, Steve and I unwittingly helped to counsel people in marriages, and which in turn, I don't know if you experience this, but when you see a problem going on in another relationship, it tends to make you look at your own. And we did that quite often. So we would just kind of self-examine on an ongoing basis. And that helped us a lot when we ran into problems, because we could look back and go, well, didn't we see this with so-and-so and so-and-so? And that life that we lived really is what kind of got us to the point where Steve actually started thinking about doing a retreat for guys after combat once 9/11 happened, and once we actively went back to being in war situations, kind of a continuous war in different countries. He really got very worried about the inability of the guys to come home and function. They were self-medicating a lot with liquor. And nowadays, there is kind of a medicinal regimen that they give, you know, something to keep you up so that you can be on the mission and on the spot, and something to bring you down so you can sleep. And so once they come home, that kind of that medical treatment is cut off. And I can't imagine, you know, bodies, everything goes through this withdrawal of sorts. And even the adrenaline goes away. That's the natural adrenaline they use. And I think that Steve just saw a real problem with too many people deciding that it was too much to handle and taking their own life. Or drinking themselves to a stupor, or divorcing their spouse and leaving their family because they just couldn't deal with going to the grocery store and taking care of the kids. I know that sounds simple, but that's a really big deal. Imagine nowadays you can get off an airplane 20 hours after you've been in combat, and you're driving down the road and you stop at a 7-Eleven or whatever, you know. It's like living in an alternative universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually read in a book, it was called War, and it was actually a reporter went, I want to say it was Afghanistan, and he interviewed soldiers, and one of the soldiers depicted it as when they're in a war zone, you know, most civilians, you know, we are very even keel, we're calm until like crisis happens, and then our anxiety goes up. And he said in a war zone, it's the opposite. They're on edge until crisis happens, and then they're even keel. So a lot of times when soldiers come back from deployment, they literally need the time to rewire themselves to be okay in normal circumstances and not on edge the whole time.
And that's really a good description of it. And it's just the opposite, you're right, of the way we live our lives day to day. And that's what I think that the diagnosis PTSD, I don't like the D, I don't think it's a disorder, but that's just my personal opinion, it's not a medical opinion. I think that gets overused a lot just because it is a term or an acronym, post-traumatic, that all of them go through. I don't think anybody comes back from combat not traumatized in some way. Some just handle it differently than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we civilians can go, gosh, our entire lives without being traumatized. Not, you know, I hope, but I think that it's just become abundantly clear that these men in particular, and I think all of the military who get so used to being part of a team or brotherhood, or just like you said, when they are there, they are geared up all the time. It's very important that they be able to revisit a little bit of that when they get home, the brotherhood at least, the feeling that they belong to something or someone and they're not alone.
Because
I think I'm going down the wrong road here. I think it's really romantic about it, but
No, I mean, because I think it's very poetic, and it's what a lot of people, I don't think, understand that, you know, just to your point, the whole time they're in deployment, they have, you know, at least one other person who has their back, and they know that person has their back. So to come back even in, you know, to a family, because of course family will always have your back, but they don't understand, they can't relate to you. So it sounds like Steve really saw this opportunity to say, let's extend that family kind of as a halfway standpoint to help ease mm-hmm. you back in from that fantasy back to this reality.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. Well said. And the importance, I think, is to be the family, almost the perfect family, that doesn't hover over you and want you to switch back because it's inconvenient or they don't understand. That's a problem, too, when families don't get it mm-hmm. and can put even more pressure on the individual to, where are you? Switch mm-hmm. back, you know. How come you don't enjoy doing this anymore? You did the last time you were here. That, and it creates a lot of guilt, and people don't even realize that when they're just making a simple statement of, before you left, you used to love to go to the grocery store and do the dishes. I'm making that up because I don't know if that's, you know. and now you won't even leave the house. And they go down this guilt trip road of making people feel pretty awful about themselves. And I can't even imagine having to deal with that and deal with what they're trying to clear from their head.
Mm-hmm.
So the double whammy.
So this became kind of you and Steve's, I'm going to call it child, this idea, and then it came into fruition. How did it come to fruition?
We lived down in, we on purpose, about 6 years before Steve was due to retire, we bought a farm down in North Carolina about an hour away from his job. And this is a little sidebar about Steve. He loved motorcycles and fast cars. And so he would always make sure we lived about 40 minutes to an hour away from his job so that he could have a nice drive. In any case, we bought the farm. It was a money pit, if you've ever seen that movie. And he spent a lot of time just remodeling everything. And then we started talking about this idea to create a place for the guys to come home. And we had this back acreage, this back 10 acres that he decided that he wanted to build little timber frame cabins. He loved to do woodwork, and that was his intention, was to retire and build timber frame, the old fashioned with no nails type thing. And so he began to build, he bought all the lumber and began to prepare to build these cabins on the back acreage down there. He was still working full time up at, running a training camp and, coming home and getting this prepared. And we, initially, it was really going to be very simple, a couple guys at a time. They could stay, they could eat, they could help around the farm. And I'm sorry, this is a big Bubba Bear barking. just something very simple, nothing elaborate. And in January of 2010, when he finally retired from both the military after 32 years active and then 2 more years under contract, he really started building quickly to get things done. And we did have a couple guys come stay with us. And then in June of 2010, he went from a bicycle ride, 16 miles. It wasn't a big deal for him because he was still working out 2.5 hours a day. And he died of a heart attack after the ride. According, I wasn't there. That's what witnesses tell me, that he secured his bike and had a massive heart attack. And he was 55 at the time, so really young, in my mind. And then I have to just be honest about it. I just went completely numb and didn't even think about anything, including the retreat side of things, for probably a year. I was just completely numb. And then I realized I had to wake up. I was still working full-time in a law office. I was still writing full-time. And I had to keep going almost 20 hours a day so that I wouldn't even think about Steve Downing. And then I came to the realization that I couldn't rent a farm on my own, which is really ironic. So I sold the farm and I sold the tractor. I sold all the implements. I gave horses away to people that I knew would love them. And then I moved to Virginia Beach. And it took probably another year of, I think, God working on my heart, saying, you need to keep this dream alive. Because even though initially it was Steve's, it was really Steve's and mine, and I started to just casually do the paperwork for a corporation, do the paperwork for a nonprofit, and really having nothing in mind for sure of what I was going to actually do. And as soon as I started that process, it's almost as if the doors started to open. And I have a theory on that, that when we are going in the direction we're called to do, the doors, it becomes easy, the doors open, and we're supported universally.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, because that's how, like, you know, I was very much into business, and I had an MBA in business. While it was extremely easy for me, I was just, every little thing would happen. It wasn't until I actually went back to get my master's in mental health did things just start opening up. And I was, anytime I, you know, had an issue or something happened, magically it would just get solved. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm meant to do. This is easy.
Yeah. Door open, right? But it's really... Isn't it wonderful, though, that you also have that the knowledge, like the business side of things, because it just helps. But I truly believe that. And I think that I'm also going to say this. I think Steve may have died from this physical place we call Earth, but he's been on this journey with me every step of the way, through dreams, through... just signs, just picking things, finding this farm, which was really a miracle in itself. There was no way I could afford anything like this. And the doors just started opening. And when he died, of course, he had life insurance. But that was more money than I'd ever seen in my life. So I just put it in. I paid everything off and put the rest in the bank. And I just thought I was leaving it there for my children. Sherry, my daughter, moved home from California. She was studying. She did her bachelor's out here in Virginia, but she was studying theology at the time and traveling the world doing mission trips. And when her dad died, she decided to move back and help me, or just be with us. I'm not sure which, but it worked out to be both. My youngest son is 26, but he's very high functioning, but he's autistic and has a lot of medical disabilities. And so, you know, he will be at home with me, you know, until we can get everything together for him to go off to university if he'd like to. But in any case, she moved home, and we started talking about this dream of her dad's and mine. And she was out one day at the time. This is important to the story just because it's so bizarre. She was training in Muay Thai, if I'm saying that correctly, MMA. And she was out with her sparring partner, who also happened to be a real estate investor. And she was telling... this friend of hers about my vision for LZ Grace. And LZ, by the way, stands for Landing Zone Grace. And so the partner said, well, you really need to look at this. It's abandoned and it's foreclosed property, but it's, you know, 38 acres down in farmland. And gosh, it sounds exactly what your mom could use to, you know, just start this retreat. And they came that day, had to climb a locked gate, came up the property, and at the very end of the driveway, very long and overgrown, was a red maple tree in full bloom, a Japanese red maple.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that's so important is because as soon as Steve was done remodeling the house in North Carolina, he and I spent hours looking for a Japanese red maple tree, spent far more money than we could afford on it, and planted it, and he loved that tree. I always thought it was so silly, but he would walk out. This is where the name came from. He'd walk out on the porch every morning with his coffee, and I'd come join him, and he'd say, you know, beside you, honey, this tree right here, this is my little bit of grace. And so, you know, grace can be biblical or spiritual or in any, I just consider it kind of what surrounds us on a constant basis if we allow it. But that's where the name came from. So she walked up the driveway. She saw this Japanese red maple in full bloom, looked all over the property for another one, and that was the only one there, the only one on this entire property, just one. She took a picture of it. And then she walked, you know, further back, and there was a little statue of St. Francis, who is significant because, you know, Steve was Catholic. And St. Francis was the saint that wanted to be a warrior and ended up protecting all living beings. I'm, of course, paraphrasing that. I'm sure not biblically, but whatever. And he was, the little statue, one of the hands was missing, and it had a hole where your and my heart would be. And she takes a picture of it and sends me a text and says, aren't we supposed to be lending a helping hand and healing hearts? And it just chills through my body. And I knew that had to be Steve's doing. And so I got in my car and I drove down here from where we were renting a house, and about 30 minutes away. And the property was for sale for $1 million. And I looked at Sherry, I said, well, there's an issue here. I don't have a job. And I don't have $1 million. And but I think we're going to own this property. And I started making phone calls. And one of the board members, I had already formed a nonprofit. I was just looking for property in Texas and South Carolina, someplace cheaper, you know, to do it. So I called one of my board members. His name is Joel Lambert, and he's out in L.A., and he's an actor now. He used to be a SEAL. And I said, Joel, you're in California. Surely you know people who can flip houses with no money. And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, let me see what I can do. And he did CrossFit training with some people, and he put me in touch with this man named Christopher Zida. And Christopher is in Beverly Hills. He owns his own investment company. He agreed to talk to me for 10 minutes on the phone and give me some advice. And so we scheduled the call and the next day. And while I'm on the phone with him, very nice person, he asked me who the board of directors was of the bank that owned the property. And I, of course, didn't know. So he looked it up on the computer. And while we were on the phone, he said, oh, my gosh, you know, I had a Bob Goldstein work for me for 12 years running a couple companies. He said, I wonder if it's the same guy. Now, I don't know Christopher from anybody. He's just being nice to me. And he said, well, hold on. And he sends this Bob Goldstein a message, an email. And while we're still on the phone, Bob Goldstein emails him back. And Christopher said, it's my friend, and we know each other well. And he said, Lynn, what do you want to do with this property? And I told him, I said, I have this amount of money. I can't spend it all because it's all I have. So can I put half of it down and will they give me a mortgage? And I promise to make the payments. I just don't know how yet. Because I don't have a job. I had retired. I spent 28 years in law offices and writing. And my writing is not, my writing income was not significant enough to say it was a job. So in any case, fast forward, Bob Goldstein, Christopher Zida helped me write up an offer. I did have to put 20% down, and I used Tapestry's life insurance to do that, and they gave me a mortgage. And that, it closed within, that was in the end of April 2014, and we closed on June 21st, 2014. So it was that fast. So you see what I mean by a series of miracles that happened?
Yeah, the doors just open.
No way does that happen, you know. They also turned down 12 cash offers to accept mine. And a lot of it had to do with what I intended to do with the property, but it still is quite a miracle in the working. Banks don't just do things for nice reasons.
And nor do total strangers that you've never met before.
Exactly right. And this Christopher Zida and I are very good friends now. And he comes out, he came and spoke at my dedication back in November of 2014. But he comes out every year now and sees the progress. And to this day, all of us kind of just stare at each other like, I don't know how it happened. Well, I know how it happened, but not everybody believes me. So that's how this all came about. And it really, I think that my life with Steve was everything that we went through in our marriage, everything that we, all the hard bumps, everything that's hard, all of the sadness, all of the joy, all of it brought me to the point where I was confident enough to say, we're doing this. And we're going to do it on a shoestring budget because I don't know where we're going to get the money, but it's happened. And this place, even though it was abandoned, used to once upon a time be a horse boarding farm. They did horse shows here. So I contacted the local fire department, and they came out and helped me get everything in good shape so that I could board horses. And that's how I paid the mortgage.
That's so, super cool.
Yeah. And now we're at the point where I've planted a hop yard. I'm growing an acre of hops to sell fresh hops to the local breweries, which will be another source of income to support the mission. And since that time, since probably... more honestly, January 2015, I've had 412 men here for various amounts of time. And that touches my heart that it really is working. And it really is all because Steve had this dream. And it was important, it was a passion to him that we be of service and help in the healing of these body, mind, soul, spirit. Coming in.
That's really awesome. And he's been with you all the whole time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I still, a lot of times I see him in dreams, but I pay attention now. You know, in the very beginning, you think, my imagination is just crazy wild. But when I'm very specifically in need of something, if I'm having a really hard time, I don't know. It doesn't even matter dealing with individuals. I get my messages pretty loud and clear through Steve, and it doesn't surprise me anymore. And I do talk about him as though he's still living and breathing and sitting in the chair in the corner, and it does bother some people. And I don't know what to say about that except that they'd have to experience it themselves.
Or so. They can get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it sounds like you and Steve's bond was, you know, very, very tight. So you know, regardless of what one would believe, you know, of course he'll wait for you to take that next journey.
I know that to be true. And for all intents and purposes, although I had really great parents and I had a really wonderful life, I grew up in Lake Arrowhead, California, if you're familiar with that area.
Yeah.
Big Bear, Lake Arrowhead.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really young when I married Steve, so I always like to say that Steve raised me. And I think he did, because I think he had a lot of sisters and a lot of nieces and nephews, and he adored that. And so he was really good at kind of bringing me along to learn how to be a wife and a mom to a lot more than those I gave birth to. So, yeah. And I don't know, I skipped around a lot. So if I've missed something important, you let me know.
No, I think it's, you know, it's a pretty impressive journey, and, you know, how it's like kind of like almost like lily pads. Each lily pad, you know, was in a, started off with you and Steve, this kind of whirlwind romance. Then, you know, the deployments and learning each other and kind of being each other's support. And then getting to get pay back to the people who, you know, Steve was in deployment with or worked with all the way up till, you know, unfortunately Steve's passing, and then the baton getting passed to you to carry on the journey you and he had started.
Yeah, it's been quite a whirlwind, and I love it. I loved every minute of it. I mean, there were times where you would have caught me screaming and yelling, but I didn't love it. But looking back, I loved it. And I write about it a lot. And I think that going forward from here, this place will start to function really well. It does now, but it will take on the life it's supposed to take on. And then I'll spend more time writing, which I have kind of put to the side lately. But I'll be able to tell the story again in a bit of a different way.
That's really, really cool. So, Lynn, I'm going to open it up to you. If you want to share any website or any contact in case listeners have any questions or want to touch base in any way.
Oh, okay. Well, the website for the retreat is www.lv-grace.com. I try to keep it up to date as far as the news of what's happening here, quite on purpose, and I've had this a lot. I do not post photographs of the people who are here. I have posted photographs of firefighters having lunch who have been here as volunteers, but nobody that comes here has ever photographed, so I'm just putting that out there because I get that question a lot. Another website to go to would be my blog. I write a lot about our life, and it's www.gracebeyondgrace.com. I put several excerpts of my book there, and it kind of tells the story of our 31-year love affair, which I like to refer to it as. So you kind of have to fall in love again every single time you see him after a 6 or 9 month hit. So, yeah. And that's it. There's, if anybody is interested in donating, there is a place to donate on the website. And or if anybody needs more information, or most importantly, if someone is in need to come to this retreat, they can contact me directly at 757-784-3220, and we can go from there.
That's awesome. And I'm going to open it up, Lynn, to any final thoughts or anything, any messages that you'd like to pay forward to anybody.
I would really like everyone to come together and be of service to those closest to you, that pay attention, open eyes, notice that not all wounds are visible. It really heals us to help others heal. I truly believe that. It's helped me in my grieving.
And I think I want to highlight too, kind of that St. Francis statue. It's always great to lend a helping hand and help, you know, heal hearts. And
yeah.
I'm really, really glad that you all are doing that.
Thank you. that was, this is really nice of you, and I'm humbled and honored that I was invited to do this. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Yeah, no problem. And Lynn, I think this has been another moment in time.